evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the stories making news across South Sudan and around the region this Wednesday, November 1st, 2023. There were reports of fighting along the South Sudan-Sudan border yesterday, and a political row is percolating between the War Upstate governor and his state lawmakers.
The parliament is still yet not open up to now. We remain with only 1 month now to another session while we did not resume our work for the first 2 months.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Authorities in South Sudan's Ruweng administrative area report that Sudan Armed Forces and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces fought in Krissala near the South Sudan-Sudan border yesterday. Charlton Doki reports for VOA from Juba.
Authorities in South Sudan's Ruweng administrative area say the Sudan Armed Forces and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces fought close to the South Sudan-Sudan border at a place called Krissala on Monday. Krissala is near the oil-producing area of Hejlej. It's not clear if there are any casualties from the clashes or who is in control of Krissala at the moment. Santo Yual Mayuen, the acting information minister in the Ruweng administrative area government, tells VOA that both South Sudanese and Sudanese civilians who live in Krissala are likely to have been affected by the fighting. He added that he has been informed the clashes spilled over from the recent fighting in South Kordofan. Mayuen also says he's been informed that calm has returned to the area. The war between Sudan's military and the paramilitary group is into its seventh month. The 200 days of fighting has caused immeasurable loss of infrastructure and trauma for much of the country's population. Some 9,000 people have been killed, and another 5.6 million have been forced to flee their homes during conflict, according to the United Nations. Since 15th April 2023, hundreds of thousands of people have crossed into South Sudan, a majority of whom are South Sudanese refugee returnees. Almost 76% entered the Wuntho-Joda border crossing point in Upper Nile State. Last month, UN Undersecretary General Martin Griffiths said in a statement that half a year of war has plunged Sudan into one of the worst humanitarian nightmares in recent history. Charlton Doki for VOA News, Juba.
Tensions are growing between the governor of South Sudan's War Upstate and state MPs. Lawmakers there say they are unable to debate several bills in parliament after the governor suspended the assembly 2 months ago. But the state's information minister claims that MPs have been absent from work for the last 2 months because they don't have the transport fare to commute to work. Munyang David Mayar has more for VOA from Juba.
Lawmakers in the Warab State Legislative Assembly say several bills are lying in parliament because MPs have not held sessions for the last 2 months. Aru Chikom, the MP representing Tony South County in the State Assembly, says parliament remains closed following an order by State Governor Maniam Bol Malek in August that stopped MPs from resuming their duties after recess and warning them not to step foot in the assembly premises or risk being arrested.
The parliament is still yet not open up to now. We remain with only 1 month now to another session. While we did not resume our work for the first 2 months, which is not legally right to the executive body to suspend the legislature in Warab State. And I'm not happy about that. So I suggest to tell to the people of Warab State that Parliament is not functioning due to the letter of the governor.
Warab State Information Minister Wolmayom admits the government blocked the reopening of parliament in August due to procedural concerns, but disputes the charge that the state assembly is still closed as a result of the governor's August order.
The clerk of the assembly announced the opening of the assembly on the 1st of September, but nevertheless, the members did not turn up to sign the quorum or the attendance to meet the quorum so that the assembly is open. So the governor is waiting for the quorum to be met by the assembly. Therefore, it should be open officially. So there is no any suspension made so far by the governor of Warab.
Warab State MP Ariech Mayar Ariech says unidentified security agents often come to the assembly to prevent MPs from signing attendance to ensure that a quorum is not met. Ariech says the state government is intentionally preventing the work of parliament to avoid debate on corruption issues that are on the table.
The governor has got the fear about no one that if the parliament is open, he's going to hold him into account. That is why he is fearing the accountability of the parliament. You know, there are a lot of things that have gone wrong and that need parliament to be in session, to be on duty. The governor is fearing that he is hearing from and confirmed first that the parliament is going to impede you.
Ariech alleges there are several important pieces of legislation pending in the state assembly, including a security bill and the proposed 2023-2024 fiscal year budget. Mayom insists that the governor's office is not afraid of state MPs pending legislative action and eagerly await their return to work.
We are governed by the laws. Assembly is a whim, and the executive, we cannot operate without assembly. We have even bills that are supposed to be passed by the assembly, and this is why it is important, it is a prerogative of the state government to open the assembly so that the bills are passed, and then they oversee also the work of the assembly, of the executive. Only few individuals who have political interest are actually betraying the good relationship between the executive and the assembly.
Mayom alleges the real reason MPs have not returned to parliament is because they do not have money for transport fare. Kanbil Noon, a civil society activist in Warab State, says state lawmakers are not in session, partly because MPs have not been paid their allowances.
Before they went for a recess, there were so many complaints from parliamentarians that the parliament has been neglected, the budget they deserve has not been approved or paid. Most of them have not been getting their sitting allowances. And for these reasons, the governor might be fearing to recall the parliament from recess.
Noon says the ongoing political dispute between Governor Malek and lawmakers has hindered the Warab State Parliament from reopening. For VOA News, Amanyang David Mayer in Juba.
Some HIV activists say confusion around funding for Washington's biggest global health program is endangering the well-being of many Africans living with the disease. The U.S. President's emergency plan for AIDS relief, called PEPFAR, was established two decades ago by former President George W. Bush to address the HIV epidemic. Now, political wrangling in Washington means funding for PEPFAR is uncertain. Darren Taylor has this report.
Since 2003, the U.S. government, through PEPFAR, says it's given more than $100 billion to governments, universities, and non-profit groups in 50 countries, saving 25 million lives and preventing millions of HIV infections.
It's absolutely essential. If you look at the difference that they've made in diagnostics, in supplying medicine, and the impact they've had on supplying essential medicines such as HIV and antiretrovirals in Africa, it can't be overstated the impact that PEPFAR has.
Michael Meinhardt is a public health specialist at the Avacare Global Group, a South Africa-based healthcare provider and medical research company. He told VOA, much of PEPFAR money's been used to provide antiretroviral or ARV medication to HIV-infected people. He credits the program with saving millions of lives in Africa, the continent worst affected by HIV. One of those people is Paula Majodina in Johannesburg. She says 15 years ago, she was ready to die.
I had TB, I had pneumonia. At some point, I was in a wheelchair. At some point, I couldn't feed myself. And I genuinely then, at that point, accepted that I'm living with HIV because of how I looked and what I was going through for the 6 months. And that is what then got me to eventually accept that I'm living with the virus and I have to take the medication so that I can live a longer life.
But going forward, Majodina's not sure she'll be getting a regular supply of ARVs. Her local clinic usually gets the drugs courtesy of PEPFAR. But refunding of the program hit a snag during a debate in Congress in late September. Republican chair of the House Global Health Subcommittee, Chris Smith, accused President Joe Biden's Democratic administration of abusing the program.
I strongly supported PEPFAR when it was created in 2003, and I was the sponsor of the reauthorization of PEPFAR in 2018. Regrettably, it has been reimagined, hijacked by the Biden administration to empower pro-abortion international NGOs, deviating from its life-affirming work. It's time we got back to the original noble idea, and that noble goal is to prevent this devastating disease, robustly treat and assist those who have been infected, not supporting abortion, the killing of unborn children by dismemberment.
Republican politicians have refused to approve a five-year comprehensive spending bill for PEPFAR unless rules prevent funds from being used to cover abortion services. The Biden administration says PEPFAR money's never been used to promote or fund abortion. Under 1973 law, no U.S. aid money can be used to provide abortion services. However, some Republicans say that language in Biden's policy allows PEPFAR money to go to organizations that use funds obtained elsewhere to provide abortion care. Republican lawmakers want that changed. For now, PEPFAR remains partly funded only for the next year. Some Republicans have indicated they'll approve 1 year of funding for now. Minot says the uncertainty around PEPFAR should spur Africa into taking action to make it less reliant on the U.S. to combat HIV.
We need to start thinking of the medium and long-term solutions and how do we create and develop self-sustainable funding models within a continent like Africa. So elements like local manufacturing, building infrastructure, becoming less reliant on importing medicines from international territories. You have to look at offtake agreements from public procurement agencies, from the government primarily, that's handing out these medicines, typically free of charge. You have to look at technology transfers. You have to look at skills development, IP development.
But for now, says South African HIV scientist Francois Venter, the political dispute over PEPFAR is playing with the lives of millions of Africans. He says if PEPFAR isn't funded in five-year cycles, its planning will be thrown into disarray, and there'll be delays in sourcing condoms and ARV medicine. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
U.S. President Joe Biden has announced plans to halt the participation of Gabon, Niger, Uganda, and the Central African Republic in a special U.S.-Africa trade program called the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, or AGOA. The announcement on Monday, in a letter addressed to the U.S. Speaker House of Representatives, comes after what President Biden describes as gross violations of internationally recognized human rights by the Central African Republic and Uganda. He cited Niger and Gabon's inability to make consistent progress in safeguarding political pluralism and the rule of law after coups in both of those countries. In part two of our conversation, Ambassador J. Peter Pham, distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council's Africa Center and a former U.S. special envoy to the Sahel region, tells me that there are certain criteria African countries must meet in order to stay in the trade program. Pham questions whether South Africa should remain in AGOA, given one of those criteria about threatening U.S. national security.
It's rather ironic, and if I were an official of one of these countries being expelled, I would say, okay, fair, I'm being pushed out because of I'm in violation of criteria that is object, but why don't you enforce the third criterion, which is not doing anything to undermine U.S. foreign policy objectives or national security, and certainly the biggest beneficiary of AGOA, South Africa, is regularly flaunting that. Even during the recent Hamas terror attacks on Israel, South Africa's foreign minister is up chummying it up with Iran's leader as the president, Raisi was spouting anti-American slogans in her presence.
Do you think South Africa is in trouble and it could be facing some sanctions with the U.S. because of that?
Well, the administration's tried to paper it over, but the fact is that leaders from both parties in Congress have raised questions. There was a letter earlier this year signed by the chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Representative Mike McCaul, but also by his Democratic counterpart, the ranking member, Greg Meeks, as well as Senator Chris Coons from the president's home state of Delaware and Senator Jim Risch, questioning whether South Africa continues to qualify under AGOA and, in fact, calling for the AGOA summit to be moved out of South Africa. I'm going to predict that it's going to be rather difficult to renew AGOA with South Africa included unless there's a drastic change in South Africa's foreign policy trajectory. And right now, I don't see that.
That is Ambassador J. Peter Pham, distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council's Africa Center and a former U.S. Special Envoy to the Sahel region of Africa. He was speaking with me here in Washington yesterday. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up on South Sudan in Focus, if Israel's military forces the Hamas to be stamped out of Gaza, who will run the enclave? Stay tuned. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. An Israeli strike on a refugee camp in northern Gaza has caused many casualties and left significant damage, according to medics in the enclave, as a border with Egypt opened for the first time since the start of the war. Israeli forces say the strike killed a top Hamas commander responsible for the October 7th attack on Israel. But Hamas has denied that one of its leaders was actually in that camp. A hospital director estimates that scores were killed in the strike yesterday, which left huge craters around densely populated buildings. As Israel intensifies its military campaign in Gaza, some experts warn that a possible scenario following the military operations could be that Israel would reoccupy the Gaza Strip and become responsible for governing the Palestinian territory. President Biden has warned it would be a mistake for Israel to reoccupy the territory, exposing Israeli troops to violent resistance. Wolfgang Putzai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, discusses this scenario with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi.
I fully agree with President Biden. This is no serious option, absolutely not. An occupation of Gaza would lead to a military, economic, and political disaster for Israel. A permanent occupation by Israel would just offer the remaining terrorists, and there will be some remaining even after a successful war from the point of view from Israel, they will just offer these people easy targets. And this would end for Israel in another war of attrition, like they had it in Gaza before the withdrawal and in the southern Lebanon. Furthermore, they would need to care for 2 million hostile Palestinians, and they would need to organize reconstruction efforts. All this would be also a heavy financial burden, and they would need to sustain a very large and very costly occupation force. And domestically and internationally, this would be a political disaster for any Israeli government, whoever is in charge of Israel after the war. And furthermore, Israel is right now, and even more after the war, in dire need of financial aid from the United States. And I don't think Washington would be ready to pay for an Israeli occupation of the Gaza Strip.
But Israel is now pushing for a transfer of Palestinians in Gaza to Sinai in Egypt.
I don't think that Egypt would be ready to accept refugees from the Gaza Strip for three reasons. The first one is the infrastructure in the northern Sinai Strip is simply not ready to host so many people. You know, the Sinai has about 600,000 inhabitants. They are simply not able to host, in addition, hundreds of thousands of more Palestinians. The second one is the Egyptian state would also not be able to organize the support for these refugees in the northern Sinai. And finally, you're aware that many of the terrorist organizations operating in Sinai, especially in northern Sinai, have their backward relationships and their backward support in the Gaza Strip. So the Egyptian security forces are certainly scared that if they let hundreds of thousands of refugees uncontrolled, more or less uncontrolled, into the northern Sinai, that quite a number of supporters of the local terrorist organizations would be among them. So I would rule out that Egypt is ready to accept this, and they can't be forced to do so by Israel.
Experts say Israel would seek to destroy Hamas, but refrain from getting involved with the messy business of governing Gaza. They warn that In this situation, the Strip could easily devolve into even further chaos and violent conflict, as different groups like Islamic Jihad will likely be even more extreme than Hamas, vying to fill the power vacuum caused by Hamas' absence.
I'm pretty sure that the Israelis will not attempt to govern Gaza, the Gaza Strip. They will depart from the Strip as soon as possible and return to Israel. But what could be a positive solution after the war? Maybe the temporary deployment of an international Arab peace or stabilization force to Gaza could be a way forward to replace Hamas and to replace the Israeli forces as a security force. I would say it would also make sense if the Palestinian National Authority of President Mahmoud Abbas could return to Gaza and replace the Hamas regime, establishing a new civilian government. But if Gaza should be seriously stabilized, huge investments by the international community will be required, by the Western Europeans, by the Americans, and by the rich Arab states. The people of Gaza need to see and need to feel that life is better for them without Hamas. And Israel, let me stress, will also need to change its attitude towards the Palestinians. They need to get the radical settlers under control who are harassing Arabs and burning down houses on the West Bank. This is not a way of cooperation, and this is not a way to get to a peaceful cooperation and coexistence with the Palestinians. They also need to give up their illegal West Bank settlements. So if they want to have peace in Israel, and I'm confident that after the war there will be even more people who want to have lasting peace, it is now more clear than ever that an independent, stable and viable state of Palestine needs to be established. Like the Yom Kippur War led to the Camp David peace agreement, hopefully the Gaza War will lead to a peace between Israel and Palestine.
That's Wolfgang Putzai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking to my colleague Mohammed Al-Shanawi. With almost daily incursions by Israeli forces into Palestinian cities and towns to arrest people suspected of being linked to Hamas, violence has been escalating in the West Bank in recent weeks. Since October 7th, more than 120 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces and Jewish settlers. Many of the deceased are members of armed groups operating in the West Bank, but nearly 30% have been children, said the UN. VOA's Jan Borchert traveled to the West Bank and has this report.
Here at the Jenin refugee camp in the West Bank, children play with toy guns in the very same place where Israeli forces killed two Islamic Jihad fighters just a few hours earlier. They run, shoot, and hide from imaginary enemies on this street. The bullet holes and bloodstains are still fresh from the recent battle. Some of the kids pretend to shoot into the air to celebrate the fallen comrades' deaths.
There's no fear. My only fear is God.
Tubar is 12 years old and has many plans in life. He says he wants to study, become a professional football player, and a fighter. Last Friday, we spent the day with him. He carried a plastic rifle, which had a picture of a friend who died while confronting Israeli forces.
He was here, and they were there. And then, boom, 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 he was dead.
Aizar al-Amer, a local commander in the Islamic Jihad militant group, was killed that morning. His funeral attracted hundreds of people in Jenin.
This is a scene that it's becoming more and more common here in the West Bank. This is another funeral of a Palestinian fighter that was killed by the Israeli forces last night. As you can see, there's a lot of tension going on here.
UN data suggests this is the deadliest year for Palestinians in the West Bank in 15 years. More than 120 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank since Hamas attacked Israel on October 7, killing more than 1,400 Israelis and sparking the Israel-Hamas war. Most Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces during incursions into refugee camps to arrest suspects linked to Hamas. Attacks by Jewish settlers have also surged in the West Bank, and the number of Palestinians killed by settlers has been increasing. In this small village near Nablus, at least five Palestinians have been killed by Jewish settlers in the last 2 weeks, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health. Murat Obeh says he was shot.
I was sleeping when I heard the loudspeaker of the mosque announcing there was an attack and people needed help. I rushed to the scene and saw my cousin lying on the ground. I put him in the car, and when I was going back to help others, a bullet hit me in the back.
Every day, new posters of deceased Palestinians are being printed and posted on the walls of Palestinian cities. With the violence escalating, many here seem to believe that the war is drawing closer than ever to the West Bank once again. Yabwe Shah, VOA News in the West Bank.
President Biden is facing a revolt from some members of his own Democratic Party over his unwavering support for Israel as it expands ground operations in Gaza. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Whitaker-Squara has more.
As Israeli airstrikes continue in Gaza, including this one on the Al-Shati refugee camp, an open letter to President Joe Biden from advocacy group the National Muslim Democratic Council, demanding that he broker a ceasefire by 5 p.m. Tuesday or face the consequence of millions of American Muslims withholding their support for his re-election next year. Council Chair Basim Al-Kara via Skype.
We know for a fact that our community will make a difference in the battleground states. And I think Democratic Party leaders are paying attention and they are afraid of what's happening. And they're sending messages to the White House that this is going to hurt our chances in 2024.
More than a million Muslim voters cast a ballot in the 2020 election, turning out in numbers large enough to potentially swing the presidential race in some battleground states. Muslim and Arab Americans traditionally vote for Democratic candidates, but a shift may be coming. A new poll by the Arab American Institute showed support for Biden dropped among Arab American voters from 59% in the 2020 election to 17% ahead of 2024. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre.
We're going to continue to engage in with the Muslim community, the Arab American community, and Palestinian American leaders to hear their concerns.
In contrast, Jewish Americans are deeply appreciative of Biden's support of Israel, said Hallie Soifer, who leads the Jewish Democratic Council of America via Skype.
Israel is an important issue, remains a very important issue to Jewish voters. It's an issue about which there's a very high emotional attachment between Jewish Americans and support of Israel.
About 7 million Jews live in the U.S., the same number as in Israel. They make up 3% of the U.S. electorate. Biden is also widely praised in Israel. He has been urging Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to conduct the war following international humanitarian law to protect civilians. Jonathan Reynolds, head of the Department of Political Studies at Bar-Ilan University via Skype.
What he's saying to Israel, to help me, to help you. If you give maximum effort to fight in the right way, according to the laws of war, then it makes it easier for me to support you and get support from you in the international community and at home in America and in the Democratic Party.
Polls show more Republicans than Democrats approve of Biden's decision to send weapons to Israel. Norman Ornstein, Senior Fellow Emeritus at the American Enterprise Institute via Skype.
I do think that there isn't a lot of room for Republicans here, whether it's Trump or the Republicans in Congress, to outflank Biden on support for Israel.
Meanwhile, there's growing pressure for a ceasefire, including from anti-war protesters during Tuesday's congressional hearing. Administration officials have advocated for humanitarian pauses to allow aid to reach civilians, but say a ceasefire at this point will only benefit Hamas. Patsy Whitaker-Squara, VOA News, Washington.
And that wraps it up for this Wednesday. Check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you missed this broadcast, head over to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. We now leave you with the song You Are One in a Million by Justin Simpleman. I'm your host, Carol Van Dam in Washington. We hope to see you back here tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Wayamu makuri ngatwa awinyukuru magekendali ibaru ya kwenye